today.ir/EN Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Revolution of 79. Part 2.
That the Americans didn't learn about it.
Because there was an unwritten...
The Shahs...
That also talked to a number of people.
On March 2nd, 1974, the Rastakhiz, or Resurrection Party, was formed at the Shah's instance. All legal parties and trade unions had to be merged into it. Soon after, membership in the party became mandatory. In one of his speeches, the Shah noted, "All people are required to join the party if they want to show their good faith to the throne. Otherwise, they have to leave the country. And if they don't leave the country, they will be sent to prison." The regime announced that passports would be issued for those not interested in the party. Mahmoud Jafarian, the vice president of Rastakhiz Party, who was once involved in communist activities, said, "It doesn't make any difference to be leftist or rightist if you're going to be disloyal to your country."
Shah seemed to be reasonably in control. He had started a new political system there called the Rastakhiz, or Resurgence Party. The idea was you'd have one party, but different views could be expressed in the party.
The revolution was still in its early stages, and the authorities attacked religious and secular opponents on every occasion. But taking down the opposition groups got the regime really in trouble.
Shah was immensely unpopular within the Iranian, within Iran. He was sick. He was dying of cancer. He wasn't at the end of, he didn't have perhaps all his faculties. The way he governed law with everything centralized control. So if anything happened to him, the government was paralyzed to do anything. I think he had serious problems no matter what happened. His son was in no shape to take over after him, nor did the Iranian people really want that, I think. I think it was a popular revolt.
I've read Professor Zoh's book, and I think it's a fascinating psychological portrait. But I've also talked to a number of people who dealt with the Shah, Iranians and American government officials. And their experience was of an extremely arrogant figure who simply did not brook any kind of opposition whatsoever, and was in control of every meeting that he walked into. I don't know how to reconcile these images, and it's certainly possible that this forceful, proud presentation might have crumbled in the face of unprecedented popular unrest, in the face of his own illness, of course, having been diagnosed with cancer.
In November 1977, the Shah made a visit to the United States. The police had to use tear gas to disperse anti-Shah protesters during President Carter's speech in front of the White House. The media captured the Shah and the president shedding tears, a scene many revolutionary groups liked. During the visit, Carter fully supported the Shah, and the Shah announced his agreement on fixing the price of oil.
To make decisions himself based on no knowledge of anything. How serious he was and where would that have actually happened, it's hard to say. It's clear that he was not friendly toward the Shah. In fact, he refused him admission to the United States even to seek medical treatment. Whether the U.S. would have ceased arms sales to any dictatorship probably would not have happened, since there are so many and they depend on, the U.S. depends heavily on arms sales. But who knows? Espersinsky.
Well, that will be a very...
We have to announce it on the air so it doesn't look peculiar. Your Majesty, are you being sold weapons in the United States in part so that you can defend our point of view?
Well, I can't really see what that means. But if you say that we are allies, I can say yes, we are allies.
In his official visit to Iran, President Carter of the United States said, "The military alliance between Iran and America is indestructible." Just a week later, Ittilaat newspaper published an insult to Ayatollah Khomeini in an article by Ahmad Rashidi Mutlaq. The article hurt public feelings and rocked the country. The epicenter was the city of Qom.
One of the most staggering things to me about the revolution and the American attitude to the revolution was the failure of American policymakers to understand just how weak the Shah of Iran was. I'm not talking about weak militarily or weak in the sense of not having a good police force. I'm talking about weak in terms of a character structure. Let me give you an example. So Jimmy Carter is the president of the United States. And Jimmy Carter thinks that the Shah of Iran is really a tough guy. And so how are we going to deal with this really tough guy? I mean, how do you deal with a guy who's, you know, walking around with these medals, right? How do you deal with a tough guy? Well, the United States has this ambassador in the Philippines. And this ambassador in the Philippines, William Sullivan, he's been dealing with Marcos, and he's been doing a great job, and everybody knows Marcos is really a tough dude. So let's send Sullivan from the Philippines to Tehran, because he knows how to handle tough guys. We don't have anybody else who's as good with tough guys. So Sullivan, who doesn't know anything about the Middle East, who doesn't know anything about Iran, and he admits this, he wrote a book, and he says this in his book, didn't know anything about Iran, he had never served in the Middle East, he had always been out there in Asia. He shows up in Tehran. Now, what was the style with which American ambassadors dealt with the Shah? This was the style. American ambassador would go to see the Shah once a week. There was always a fixed time for a meeting. And the Shah would welcome him and the Shah, and they'd chat a little bit of small talk. And then the Shah would say, "I have come up with this brilliant plan for the future of my country. We are going to build a superhighway from Tehran to Mashhad, all the way across northern Tehran. And it's going to cost us such and such, and it'll take so long to build this, and that's what's going to happen." And the American ambassador would say something like, "Your Majesty, this is a brilliant plan. Only you could have thought up the strategy for making your country prosperous. It's going to be great. But I have one slight suggestion. Maybe instead of building the superhighway, you should pave some roads from the villages to the main road so that farmers could get their crops out to market, and that would increase the income for the poor villagers." And the Shah would say, "Exactly what I was thinking. This was what I was going to do. That's it." And so then the Shah would go out and make some roads from the villages to the main roads. Well, that was the way the Americans tried to influence the Shah's behavior. And everybody understood this was a Sullivan comes to Tehran. And he tells us in his book. And he sits down with the Shah for the first interview. And the Shah says, Ambassador Sullivan, this is what I think I'm going to do. And he gives this whole thing. And Ambassador Sullivan looks at him and says, Majesty, you're the Shah. Whatever you think is right, that's what you should do. The Shah was stunned. What do you think the Shah heard when Ambassador Sullivan said, you're the Shah, whatever you want to do is you should do? Sullivan was being honest. He didn't know what the hell to do in Iran because he didn't know anything about Iran. And he figured the Shah's a tough guy. He had been there for a long time. If that's what Shah thought was right, that's what he should do. The Shah didn't hear that. What the Shah heard was, you should do whatever you want to do, meaning the government of the United States doesn't care what you do. We don't give a damn. You do whatever you want to do, meaning we don't care about you anymore. The Shah was devastated.
Opinion is divided as to whether the Shah was conscious of his illness. But one thing is for sure. During the last years of his reign, the Shah was always in two minds, unable to make right decisions. What's more was that he was half afraid that the Americans would take him off the throne if they knew about his illness. In the spring of 1978, political prisoners in Qasr prison went on a hunger strike. As the new Iranian year of 1357 came in, Ayatollah Khomeini issued a proclamation paying tribute to Tabriz martyrs and attacking the United States of America. He said, "The US is the root cause of the hardship we're suffering because it supports the despotic Shah." The Shah had kept his cancer secret, even from his nearest and dearest. But the symptoms of the disease were undeniable. The Shah's inability to make decisions was one.
The Shah was ill. We did not know the Shah was ill. In fact, I've got a thing going with Gary Sick. I learned from a very good source that the Americans didn't learn about it until October. Now, Sick, who was the White House National Security Council person, says that no, they never didn't hear about it till then. They didn't hear about it to almost 6 months later. Clearly, if we had known the Shah was ill, we would have seen the problem not as one of political adjustment, but of regime survival, and everybody would have behaved differently in that case.
There were rumors that the Shah was not well, but even after he left the country, he had pictures of him playing tennis. He was a man who was very fit. He gave the impression of being in perfectly good health. And truly, we didn't know about it. And there are lots of people who say, oh, you must have known. Well, we didn't. It actually would have made a huge difference. And the fact is, the Shah fully understood that if people knew that he had cancer, they would change their policy toward Iran because they would know that he wasn't going to be there in a few years. So they would change their policy, and it's true. But in fact, the CIA formally concluded in August of 1978 that the Shah of Iran was in no serious trouble, and that he would be around for many years to come, for the next 5 to 10 years.
If we had known something about his condition, we could have gone to him and said, "Look, you know, we're talking about regime survival here. Do you want your son to be slaughtered in the streets after you're gone? Well, then maybe we better." So I told Charlie Noss, I could even write that set of talking point.
That you mentioned.
But nobody thought the unthinkable until it was too late. You know, absolutely committed to the Shah, at least through the Jalalabad Square riots, either in my or one of the other cities about the time is that. Before the Shah moved the Jalalabad Square riders, he wanted to know if it was all right with the American, if it was okay with the Americans. And Brzezinski told him on the telephone, it's a problem of order. Of course, we would be behind you if you do that. And then I learned from my Iranian friends later that some said, well, the Shah didn't really believe him. He says, yeah, we'll go around and kill him, and then we'll take the heat later. As Marvin Zonas says, he had no balls.
On April 14, 1978, Asadullah Alam died from cancer in New York City. The Shah lost his chief advisor.
Remember that the pillar of the regime, the really tough guy who really helped the Shah to be strong and as tough as he needed to be. And I think we have to be very sympathetic here. It was not easy to be the Shah of Iran. And the Shah, who was a weak character, found it especially difficult to be the Shah of Iran, which is what's wrong with hereditary monarchies. I mean, his father was a real tough guy. The Shah wasn't a tough guy. So who was the guy that made him tough? Asadullah Alam, his boyhood friend, the guy who was prime minister when I first arrived in Iran, and Khomeini was arrested, and the Shahs didn't know what to do, and Alam said to the Shah, go out and shoot these guys, and you'll stay in power, and he did it. Alam died of cancer just before the Iranian Revolution began. So the Shah lost a tremendously important advisor.
As the revolution gained momentum in Iran, the Shah blamed the U.S. for withdrawing its support, having no idea how influential the clergy were in leading the revolution. Meanwhile, Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State, came to Iran to meet with the Shah. But neither the Americans nor the Shah's men had a finger on the pulse of the revolution. Barking on the wrong tree, they had been focusing their attention just on leftist forces for several years. There is no doubt that Ayatollah Khomeini was successful in extending his influence over the whole Middle East, and not just Iran. As an Iranian religious scholar and political leader, he managed to make his country the world's first Islamic republic. Being an outspoken critic of the regime, Ayatollah Khomeini used to denounce the Shah's programs. In a proclamation issued by him and undersigned by 8 senior Islamic scholars, the Ayatollah specified the Shah's violations of the Iranian constitution and condemned him for corrupting public morals and kowtowing to the US and Israel. On the dawn of November 4, 1964, the Shah's commandos surrounded Ayatollah Khomeini's house in Qom. They arrested him and took him directly to Mehrabad Airport in Tehran. Soon after, he was flown out of Iran to Turkey. Out of sight, out of mind. That was the rationale behind his exile. The stay in Turkey was not congenial, for Turkish law didn't allow Ayatollah Khomeini to wear the cloak and turban of the Muslim scholar. September 5, 1965, he left Turkey for Najaf in Iraq, where he would stay for 13 years. On October 23, 1977, Mustafa Khomeini, the Ayatollah's son, passed away in Najaf. Defending national independence, Ayatollah Khomeini chastised the Shah's regime, saying, "We witnessed that while Muslims were in war with Israeli forces, Iran's government recognized the Israeli state on the Shah's orders." In 1978, mass protests were organized to support Ayatollah Khomeini. The regime, as usual, responded with an iron fist. Alarm bells had started to ring.
Yeah, I don't think on the part of official Washington there ever was much understanding of the Ayatollah. There were some few academics who had tracked his sermons, were aware of his views from... For those years he was in exile in Iraq, and then that sudden appearance in the Paris suburbs, it didn't really penetrate official thinking in Washington, who he was, what he was. I mean, the Shah knew him as an enemy, and that was I think that was it, black and white enemy.
Ayatollah Khomeini was in the neighboring country of Iraq, and it was too close for comfort. At the Shah's instance, the Iraqi regime asked the Ayatollah to give up his political activities, otherwise he had to leave the country. In October 1978, Ayatollah Khomeini flew from Iraq to a new exile in a suburb of Paris. By that time, the Ayatollah had developed an international reputation as the spiritual and political leader of the Iranian Revolution. Being thousands of kilometers away from his homeland, Ayatollah Khomeini set the course of the revolution, urging Iranians not to compromise and ordering work stoppages against the regime. During the last few months of his exile, the Ayatollah received a constant stream of reporters, supporters, and notable personalities, all eager to hear the leader of the revolution speak.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the standard of human dignity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the standards of human dignity in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that there are some standards which are set by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala about the human dignity, and we must have those standards, we must follow the standards. In the Quran, Allah has clearly said in chapter 49, verse 13, that inna akramakum indallahi atqakum, that certainly the most honorable person or the noble person in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one who observes taqwa, those who are God-fearing. And this is the first and foremost standard for the human dignity, that taqwa is known as the main and the major standard for the human dignity. Therefore, when we want to live a life, an Islamic lifestyle, and we want to have this dignity, then obviously we need to have taqwa, we need to observe taqwa, we need to be God-fearing. And for in order to be God-fearing, the simplest thing is that the taqwa can be translated as to not to disobey Allah. Anything in which there is a disobedience of Allah, this is against taqwa, this is against being muttaqi. So therefore, it is necessary for every single Muslim who wants to have an Islamic lifestyle to have the taqwa. And the beautiful thing about the taqwa is that when we look at the Allama Tabatabai's views about this, he takes taqwa equals to the iman. He says that a person who is mu'min must be a muttaqi. We cannot have a mu'min without taqwa. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the standards of the human dignity in the Islamic lifestyle. We mentioned that according to the Islamic teachings, the main standard of the human dignity is known as taqwa, or be God-fearing. And the definition, the simplest definition of the taqwa, can be done as not to disobey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not to disobey the God who has created us. There are other definitions, and that can be said that this can be securing our nafs, ourselves, from anything which is harmful for the humans. And when we say the things that are harmful, it means that Allah has made this clear that what things are harmful. For example, if alcohol is forbidden in Islam, it is because it is harmful. If the meat of like pig is, it's been forbidden, it is because it is harmful. If it is said that to eat animals that are allowable, which are halal, by taking the name of Allah on them and slaughter them in the Islamic way. If you do other than this, that is forbidden. It means that is harmful. Therefore, if it is said for our sisters to observe the hijab, if they do not, there is a harm in it. For the brothers to not to look at the non-mahram, if they look, there is a harm in it. So therefore, everything that we see in the Islam, which is halal and haram, it is on the basis of their being harmful and their being beneficial for the human beings. Therefore, taqwa means to observe the basics of the halal and haram in our life. If we can perform this, if we can have a life in which we are not disobeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then obviously we are the ones about whom Allah has said in the Quran that inna akramakum, certainly the noblest people amongst you are the ones in the near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, atqaakum, those amongst you who have taqwa, who are God-fearing. And in Allah alimun khabir, and certainly Allah knows the better. So inshallah, let's strive for the taqwa and practice taqwa in our lives, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Exxon hoarded $56 billion in profits last year, crushing the previous record for profits set by a Western oil company. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, riding on the wave of sky-high gas prices and industry-wide price hikes, oil giant Exxon was handed the highest profits ever reported by Western Oil Company in 2022, its latest financial report reveals. The company reported recently that it made a net profit of $55.7 billion in 2022, roughly 2.5 times its 2021 profits of $23.6 billion. This represents $6.3 million in profits per hour on average last year, Reuters pointed out. This doesn't just break the record for yearly profits for a Western oil company. It completely crushes the previous record. Last year's profits surpassed the previous high set by Exxon in 2000 8 by over $10 billion. Exxon's profits come at the expense of the public, not just because of the literal expenses at the gas pump, but also because of the company's role in advancing and denying the existence of the climate crisis with its fossil fuel products, which are steadily eroding the livability of the planet. Fossil-free media director Jamie Henn said that Exxon's profits are especially egregious when put in context with the role in helping oil and gas industry to be a larger player in the world's energy market, which combined with the country's crisis that has also played a part in causing gas prices to soar. Henn told Truthout via email, "This year's profits are really beyond the pale. Exxon's profits are particularly galling because they are profiting off a crisis they helped create. Exxon worked with people for decades to expand oil and gas production so much so that this company awarded Exxon's former CEO Rex Tillerson a Medal of Friendship." Add to that the report that came out this month about how back in 1970s, Exxon predicted with pinpoint accuracy the climate catastrophe we are now experiencing, and you start to see exactly what a criminal enterprise this company is engaged in, Henn continued, adding it's robbery on a planetary scale. Other oil giants also posted extreme increases in their profits last year, gathered in large part due to soaring gas prices that drained Americans' wallets, as they were also hit by inflation in nearly every other sector. Marathon Petroleum and Phillips 66 posted profits totaling nearly $25 billion, with Marathon enjoying a 46% year-over-year increase, with Phillips multiply its 2021 profits by 3.5 times. Altogether, the three oil majors that posted profits recently raked in over $82.5 billion in profits in 2022, in large part off the backs of the public. The companies also revealed in earnings calls that they had spent $46.6 billion on stock buybacks and dividends in 2022, PayAccountable.us, handing piles of cash to their shareholders and executives as the working class suffered a lot. Chevron also reported record profits in its quarterly report posted recently, which showed that the company doubled its profits last year, gathering $36.5 billion in profits. The company also announced last week that it is tripling its stock buyback program to an eye-popping $75 billion, one of the largest stock buyback plans ever carried out. These profits came as a result of oil and gas companies' decades-long strategies to deny the existence of the climate crisis and delay action to draw down fossil fuels. Oil and gas companies have known internally for decades that reliance on fossil fuel would cause major climate destruction, threatening millions, if not billions, of human lives, but have spent decades covering it up and persuading politicians to let them continue the industry's grip on the global energy market. Climate advocates like Henn have called for a windfall tax on big oil in response to what they say is price gouging. They say that such a tax would discourage oil companies from arbitrarily inflating prices while putting money back in the pockets of the public. Big Oil has imposed a private tax on the American people to the tune of more than $90 billion from just two companies alone, said Public Citizen President Robert Weizmann in a statement, adding, "This industry is out of control. Big Oil is price gouging us to record profits while destroying the ability of future generations to live on our planet." Meanwhile, consumers spent last year paying high prices to put fuel in their cars and are spending more to heat and power their homes this winter. Last fall, President Biden threatened oil companies with a windfall tax to capture their excess profits if gas prices continue to stay high, as they had nearly all year. Gas prices did indeed decrease slightly then, but started rising again this month and could continue surging to over $4 a gallon by this spring, analysts predict. These prices increases are happening alongside Republican moves to even further limit the government's ability to ease gas prices, as the party has taken over control of the House. Meanwhile, Arab News wrote in this regard, Exxon said it incurred a $1.3 billion hit to its fourth quarter earnings from EU windfall tax that began in the final quarter and from asset impairments. The company is suing the EU, arguing that the levy exceeds its legal authority. Excluding charges, profit for the full year was $59.1 billion. Production was up by about 100,000 barrels of oil and gas per day over a year ago to 3.8 million BPD. Adjusted per share profits of $3.40 beat consensus of $3.29 per share, according to Refinitiv data. Shares were up about 1% at $114.70. It's a headline beat, Biraj Borkataria from RBC Capital said in a note, despite lower chemical margins, lower than expected downstream gains and plans for higher maintenance works in refineries this quarter.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Uh, we're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chawbid, our guest speaker, he's kind enough actually to shed some light on some of the rules and regulations of Islamic laws, especially from a couple of episodes ago onward, we are focusing on purification and the rules about it. Sheikh Chawbid, you know, is it sufficient to purify the urinary outlet using pieces of a stone if one, for example, has no access to water?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it is absolutely not sufficient to use stones or any hard objects to purify the urinary outlet. Contrary to the excretory outlet, which can be made pure using three pieces of stones or more than three pieces of stones, the urinary outlet must be washed, and of course, if one uses little water, it has to be washed twice, and if one uses cool water or running water, washing it once is sufficient.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yes. Okay. Sheikh Chawbid, are there any places where relieving oneself is considered unlawful, haram, according to the Islamic Sharia?
Of course, there are, religious authorities have stated in their manuals of Islamic laws that there are some places where it is forbidden for people to defecate or to urinate. And they have mentioned, for example, one of the places which is forbidden to defecate is the blind alleys, without the permission of people who live there, if there is an alley which is blind, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So,
at that end.
Yeah. It's haram to urinate there or to defecate there unless the people in the street and in that alley consent to it, mm-hmm. Of course. And morally speaking, it's not good to defecate in public places, regardless of what the people think or whether they permit or not, Defecation in public or public defecation is obscene. It is not good at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then the religious authorities have said that it is haram to defecate on the property of another person who has not granted permission, mm-hmm. okay? You have, for example, a piece of land which you want to be pure, but okay, and you do not consent to someone urinating on it or defecating there, so it's not permissible either. Now, this is number two, and then number three, defecating or urinating at places which is waqf or which is considered to be an endowed property, because an endowed property has certain beneficiaries, okay, and it's permissible for the beneficiaries to use it for their own benefits or for their own needs. For the purposes for which it has been endowed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, because it has certain beneficiaries, so it's not permissible to defecate or urinate there without their permission. Now, there are some places, public places, like, for example, there is a mosque, which is an endowed place, but it has a toilet and a bathroom mm-hmm. facility.
Yes.
Of course, it's for the public, for people who mm-hmm. come there, who go there, and who pray there, who make a wudu, and then they prepare themselves for the prayer. There's no objection to them to do that, to urinate in the bath, using the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, there's also another place which is haram to urinate. It is the graves of the mu'mineen or the believers, okay? And sacred places whose sanctity must be upheld and which cannot be defiled. Now, of course, there are many such places, okay? Many such places. Speaking about the graves of Mu'minin, of course, Mu'minin are everywhere in the graveyards. People go there. They're most people who are buried in the, and for example, in the Shia cemetery, they are Mu'minin, yeah. Okay? They are Shia believers.
Right.
And of course, it's haram to defecate or to urinate on their graves. And also in places which are holy and sacred and which need to be respected, it is haram to urinate.
Sacred by the Muslims or by other
religions?
No,
for Muslims, Like, for example, let's go to the holy, give the example of the holy sites.
Mm-hmm.
We have many holy sites,
right.
And those belonging to the imams, those belonging to the imamzadas, the offspring of the imams, they are holy in the eye of the Shia Muslims. So it's not permissible.
Unless there are public conveniences.
Of course.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah.
'cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Mahajad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. Still, we are hovering around the rules of purification with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, let me ask you this question. You know, we know that it's unlawful, ritually speaking, to sit with one's back or face toward Qibla, or in the direction of the Qibla, while urinating and defecating, as you've tried many times to explain this issue in this program or in the other episodes that we have been together discussing it. What about the children? What about the minors? They may do it because they don't know anything about the Sharia law. What can we do? What can adults do about it?
Well, according to His Eminence, it's recommended that even a child should be made to sit in the toilet with his face or with her face, mm-hmm. or back, not in the direction of Qibla, because they should be educated. The children, as long as they can be taught, it is recommended that they be taught that they should not sit and with their faces or their backs towards the Qibla. And it's the duty of the parents to teach them, to educate them, to help them learn the Islamic Sharia. And when they, for example, use the bathroom, they should use it in a proper way. And obviously, Muslims, Shia Muslims, of course, are Muslims, generally speaking, they have their toilets, and the toilet is not in the direction of Qibla. So the direction is deviated from the side of the Qibla. Mm-hmm. And in few cases, such thing might happen, that children might sit with their faces or backs towards the Qibla. So in that case, it's the duty of the parents or those who know and those who can educate those children not to tell them not to sit in the direction of Qibla.
Even though the children, the minors, are not duty-bound?
Yeah, they are not duty-bound. Of course, they are not. But it is recommended. It's not obligatory. It's recommended to educate them, to teach them from an early age. Even if they watch prayers, fasting, and, other duties are not obligatory on them. Right. But it is highly recommended to begin teaching them from an early age.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, for your nice contribution and answers to these different complicated questions that I ask and raise. And sometimes some of these questions are raised by other people, and we just recite them here in this program. And thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program, for joining us on this program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim, Mannan Kareem, Salam Alim, La ilaha illa hu, Ghaffar Jameel, Wahhab Latif, تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.